Access number 30283, Reel 1.
Barry Priest, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in West Jewell, Surrey, on the 17th of October 1940.
And how long did you stay there for?
The day I started at grammar school, I was just before my 11th birthday, we moved across to Kingston.
And so you were in West Jewell for quite a while?
Yes, yeah, first 11 years, yeah.
What was it like? What kind of area was it?
It was a very pleasant area because it was on the edge of the Greenbelt, so at the back of our house we had fields and parks and things to wander over, so we had a great time. It was a very nice area to be brought up in.
And what did your dad do?
My father worked for department stores. He worked for Bentalls in Kingston. Obviously, when I was born, he went off to the war. He was a gunner with the Royal Artillery, so he didn't come back from the war until 1946. And then he went back working in retail at Derry and Toms for most of the time, I suppose. And then he left there and went to another store in Lewisham.
Did he tell you much about what he remembered from the war?
Not a lot, no. He went across on D-Day plus six, and he fought really all the way through then till the end of the war in 45. He suffered hearing problems, which was partly, I think, probably induced by being 6 years with the guns, but obviously in later life, that's just a normal ageing process. No, he didn't really tell us a lot about it, and I regret now that we never really questioned him about it. But I suppose, like lots of guys then, looking back, it was probably quite an adventure for them, having come out of it in one piece. No, he never said an awful lot about it. I think he was also involved with the concentration camps at the end as well, which is probably perhaps another reason why he didn't want to really say much about it. I know he was fairly soon into one of them at the end here.
And what about your mum?
My mum trained as a tailoress, and she came from Wimbledon, and she was married and widowed fairly young, and so she had a son when she met my father, and they were working in London. I think it was, might even have been John Lewis in Oxford Street when they met, and then they moved on from there. And she was, through the war years, I suppose, basically a housewife. And things were fairly tight because the army didn't pay much during the war. And I think my father was basically a private, probably through most of the war, or a gunner, should we say. I think he might have been a lance sergeant. I have a photograph, or we had a photograph at some stage of him with sergeant stripes up, but he was a lance sergeant. And so things were fairly tight through the war. And he came back in 46, and she did various jobs then, mainly in the works room, in stores, because that's what she'd been doing when they met.
And do you have any memories of sort of, you know, what did you get up to as a boy?
We had a great childhood, really, because I was the youngest of three, and I'd say my stepbrother was the eldest, and then my brother and I. And we just roamed far and wide. The Greenbelt was there. There was a river running along the bottom of our garden, so we were forever getting what we call booties, you know, getting a foot in it. We're making swings across the river. Saturday morning pictures, and if Robin Hood was on, then we were into bows and arrows, and if it was cowboys, then obviously it was cowboys. But we had this vast playground which stretched, Yule sounds these days, I suppose it is fairly built up, but it just went for miles, and we could climb trees and all the rest of it. So from that point of view, yes, it was a great childhood, yes. Completely sort of unrestricted, really.
And what about school? How did you do at school?
I went to local primary school, Ruxley Lane. I passed 11 plus. I don't think it was a flying pass, but and I went to Sutton Grammar School. And as I said earlier on, the day I started at Sutton Grammar School, I went from West Jewell to the school and came back to the house in Kingston. There they moved that day. So, and Sutton Grammar School again was a really good old-fashioned grammar school, which gave a great education, and I had a super time there. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Why was that? What did you enjoy?
I suppose it was being with the people. There's all sorts of things. Now, I belonged to the Combined Cadet Force, which was the start of the military thing, I suppose. I played football. I played in the school teams, and every year I played soccer. And athletics, did a lot of athletics. It was a nice number. You know, there was about 650 boys, so most people knew most people, and you certainly knew the staff. And it was just a nice atmosphere, and it was. I suppose I haven't got anything else to compare it with, but no, it suited me, and it made the demands on me that brought the best out of me, I suppose. And so, yeah, it was good. So, good school.
Can you tell me about the combined cadet force?
Yes, most grammar schools in those days, I suppose, had them, and they were obviously funded by the services just to encourage people into the service eventually. So you started. You couldn't do it in the first one. I'm not actually can't remember what the second or third one you started. And you went into the army section. You had to be in the army section, and you did at least a year there. And then after that year, you could go either into the navy section or the air force section. And at that stage, I had the feeling that I wanted to fly aeroplanes for a living. So that was the I went into the RAF section, which was very useful because when it came time to do selection for the air force, then it's obviously helps to have that sort of background that you know, you've done things and you've got the reports from the teacher stroke officer in charge to do you know, put you through the process, the selection process.
What made you know that you thought you wanted to fly airplanes? But where did the interest come from?
This is going to sound very silly, but I think probably Biggles books, literally that, just reading that, and I suppose we have these innate feelings, you know, but I had the feeling I didn't want to do a job where I was sitting in an office all day. I wanted to be out and doing something, and this I read that, and from then on there was no other thought, and that's what I wanted to do, which is very useful, I think, because it gives you something to aim at, and if you know what you've got to aim at, and you know you've got to get 2A levels if you want to get into Cranwell, then you tend to work and do that rather than drifting because you're not too sure what you want to do. So it was quite early on the decision that yes, the Air Force was what I wanted to do. Flying aeroplanes is what I wanted to do.
Can you remember much about what the cadet force taught you, either the army section or the RAF section?
Well, the army section, obviously, you were out and about. I suppose basically it gave you your first chance at command because you know, and you had NCO ranks in the cadet force. So I worked my way up through all the corporal, sergeant, flight sergeant, and unusually, I eventually became under officer. But I think that was because the guy in charge realised that when I went for selection to say I'd been an under officer, well, it was a useful thing to have in the kit bag for selection. So, yeah, it was dealing with people, the experiences. My first flight was through the CCF, you know, up in Nottinghamshire. We went to a RAF Hucknall, which in fact I think was basically a Rolls Royce airfield, and we got airborne in an old Anson. And much to the disgust, I think, of my fellow cadets, I was quite junior, and I got in the front seat next to the pilot because there were two seats at the front, but only one pilot, so there was that seat was there, and so my very first flight, I was sitting in the right hand seat at the front, and you know, that was it. From then on, there's no thought of anything else. That was really what it was. So yes, it taught you, I suppose, gave the advantage that I knew I was going to enjoy flying, which is a bit of act of faith because I'd never been airborne when I decided I want to be a pilot, and it gave you the idea of command of men and you know, and how the structure worked.
What was it about being up there that was said?
I don't know, it's just the freedom, I think. My very last flight, which was, 6 years ago now, when I was with Britannia Airways, I had exactly the same love of it as that first flight, you know, just seeing the whole world spread below you. There are no boundaries, you can, you know, it's absolutely, it's a lovely freedom. It's a good balance between an intellectual pursuit and a manual pursuit, and it paid quite well as well. Yes, so that was the first flight, and that's the first flying experience anyway, yes.
And were there any more flying experiences with the cadets?
Yes, oh yes. We went on a camp every year, I think it was probably about a week, and we went to various places. We went to Henlow, which is just down the road here, up to Kinloss, which was Shackleton's in those days, and Turnhill, yeah, and we got airborne in... not always the aircraft of that station. They very often flew in chipmunks and things to get us airborne. But yes, we... and also, towards the end of time in the CCF, I got a flying scholarship, which gave you 30 hours flying up to a private pilot's licence. So I did that as well.
So how did you get that? Was there an application
process? You just filled in a form. You need the endorsement of the officer in charge of the cadet force. And then you went for a selection process, A for aptitude and B to see you're the right sort of guy they wanted. And yeah, you got selected right on that. So
where did that actually take place?
That was at Fair Oaks Airfield at Cobham, which was not far away from Kingston, just going west a bit out of Kingston. And Old Grass Airfield and Flying Tiger Moths, which was absolutely wonderful. Which was where Roger, I mean, you interviewed Roger on it, didn't you? Yes, in fact, Roger went to the same place. Not that we knew each other then, I think he went just before me. So, and yeah, we did 30 hours there, which was great fun, absolutely wonderful fun, yeah.
I don't know how much you remember, but can you talk me through? Can you remember your first session there? We're quite interested in how people learn to fly.
Yeah. There must have been some sort of ground school, and I can't remember a lot about it, but yes, you would you'd jump in the aeroplane, fairly simple, the Tiger Moth. You obviously learned just walking around it and doing all the normal checks that you do on any aeroplane before you take it flying. Communication was difficult because you sat in the front seat, the instructor sat in the back seat, and I don't think we had headsets. I think it was sort of Gosport tubes where you sort of shout at each other. Wind it up, taxi out, get everyone. Obviously, initially, then he's doing all the flying, all the taxiing, does the takeoff, and you just start off by I suppose it's the same practice. I mean, I eventually became a flying instructor. The same, probably just the same structure. You go through the basics, how the controls work, what they do, and slowly you'd spend more and more time at the controls. He spends less and less time at the controls. The one thing I do vividly remember was my very first spin, because the Tiger Moth was an open cockpit aeroplane, and all you had were these about six straps to hold you in, which, of course, in the early days, you tended not to do too tightly because it was a bit restricting. But after you did your first spin, when the thing suddenly went like sort of nose down, and I can remember it vividly now because we were over the Hog's Back, and we were about 3,000 feet looking down at the Hog's Back with nothing between me and it, and apart from these straps. So after that, the straps got done up a bit more tightly. But yeah, it was just amazing fun, because the Tiger Moth is a lovely aeroplane. And it's one of the privileges, I think. I expect perhaps Roger finished flying before I did, but the Tiger Moth really was almost the early days of flying, and I finished up on the 767s, which was quite modern, so it's getting a bit dated now. But I've seen a whole gamut of the sorts of aeroplanes. It was quite a privilege. The Tiger Moth was lovely, yes, and it was a relaxed atmosphere. It was run. The chief instructor was a Wing Commander Arthur, I think had been in the First World War. A bit doddery, I think. I mean, or perhaps that's an 18-year-old thinking about somebody who he's probably younger than I am now. I don't know, but it was great fun, and it was a nice time.
And what happened next?
I'm again trying to think of the memory. I got a feeling I did the flying scholarship selection, but whether I'd done the flying scholarship before I then went to. An RAF scholarship. This meant that the RAF would fund you through sixth form. Now, I went to a state school, so monetary wise, it wasn't a big deal. I didn't in fact get a cadet scholarship, so I got about £25 a term, which I suppose in those days was quite an amount of money, but basically it was aimed at people, I suppose, going to private school, and the fees were, they got a big contribution towards the fees. So I remember going to the selection in those days was at Hornchurch. I don't know if you know the London tube system very well. So I was at Kingston, and I got a train to Wimbledon. I then got on the district line, and I went 36 stations on the district line to Hornchurch.
I should confess, I actually grew up in Upminster.
Oh, right. Yes, right. So
it's
was
a long way.
Yes, I did that journey about three times, because I did it the first time when we went for selection, and then I did it again just before I joined the Air Force. You had to go for a medical, so I had to do it again then. But yes, so I went 36 stations across to Hornchurch and went into the selection procedure there, which again, probably a procedure that hadn't changed much. But medicals, obviously the rushing backs and forwards and giving urine samples, having your heart and all the other things, and standing on one leg. And then into the classroom, basically doing these papers, logic papers and this sort of thing. They had one or two machines which just to try and check your dexterity, one of which was a rotating drum with a ribbon on it with holes in it. So if you followed the ribbon and got your contact into the holes, it made an electrical circuit and it just marked it off. So the drum went round and you were trying to fiddle along, and they were, again, obviously got some sort of marking off that. and then there was a television screen with a dot on it, and you had to try and keep the dot in the middle or something. All these sorts of tests. So that was for about 3 days, and of course people disappeared, because medical-wise or otherwise. Finished up with interviews, and at the end of all that, you sat in this vast room, obviously nervous as hell, with everybody else, and then somebody would come in and shout out the names, and this was to go on to Cromwell. So a proportion of us, and I can't honestly remember what the proportion was, were selected then to jump on a bus next day and drive up to Cromwell, to it was quite a reasonable size and building, called Daedalus House, which it was inevitably known by everybody as Daedalus House. And you stayed there, and that's when you started doing these, again, more interviews, and these exercises trying to move imaginary bombs across chasms with pieces of wood and ropes and this sort of thing. And you each took a turn at leading one of these exercises. And the selectors would be wandering around with their clipboards watching what you were doing. Again, I suppose it must have been nervous, but in many ways it was great fun. And there was even a bar there in Daedalus House in the evening. So, you know, you got to start to know people. So that was that process, and then you went away and waited for results. And it was quite interesting, really, because, yes, this must have been 57, because while I was waiting, Duncan Sands, who was Minister of Defence at the time, came out with this idea that the Air Force was not really going to need many pilots in future because it was all going to be done by missiles. This was the early days when missiles were being developed. And so the thought was, well, was there going to be a career in the Air Force? You know, were they going to need pilots? So there was a doubt occurred at that stage as to whether it was a wise move to make. But as soon as the letter arrived saying that I'd been selected and I was going to Cromwell, that was out the window, you know, there was no doubt about it. And at school I started off doing 4 A-levels. You need 2 to get into Cromwell. I started off doing physics and chemistry, pure maths and applied maths. Although I'd got chemistry at O-level, it very quickly became apparent that A-level chemistry and I didn't mix, because it was all organic chemistry. And so I did the physics, pure and applied. And we did 2 years, obviously, in the sixth form, as they still do. But at the end of the first term in the second year of sixth form, the school as an experiment put a lot of us into A-levels early. It was, 2 terms early. The pass mark was 40%, and I got 238% in pure and applied maths, which I think was probably a good thing I didn't pass then, because I'd have wasted 6 months. Certainly my friends were glad I didn't pass then, because they were still working away to get their university grades. So, sixth form was, apart from the CCF, it was absolutely great, because the school was on a fundraising kick at the time, so we did all sorts of things raising money, including a chorus line of sixth formers doing the Charleston in girls' dresses on the school fete day and things like that. It was, the sixth form was just great, and I knew what I wanted to do. I was fairly confident that I would get to having, you know, 6 months earlier got nearly past them, and that I would get the grades. So it was just great fun, and yes, it was good times.
And how did your parents feel about you getting into Cromwell?
They were obviously delighted. But there was always that reservation about all flying is a very dangerous thing, which it is and it isn't. But they were always very supportive, yes. There was never any problems that, I say, they always had that doubt. But yes, I think very, very proud, yes, that, because it wasn't easy, but it was nice to know that what you wanted to do and you could do. I always feel very privileged that I spent my life really doing what I would have done as a hobby, you know, Yeah.
And so what came next? When did you start Cromwell?
Started Cromwell in 59.
Can you remember which month is that?
September.
September.
Yeah, September 59.
Can you remember your first day?
Yes, I can remember going. I went up by train. And I've got a feeling my parents came with me as far as King's Cross. But I had this, the rail warrant to get from the Air Force to go up to Cromwell. And I can remember standing on King's Cross Station, and there was this other guy there, another 18, 19-year-old, and you could all tell exactly who we were, because we were the only 18, 19-year-olds wearing a hat, because you had to have a civilian hat, when you went to Cromwell, and all the time through Cromwell in those days. So the only other geek standing on there with a hat was obviously going to Cromwell as well, and that was a guy called Nigel Baldwin, who you know, we I subsequently spent 3 years with a Cranmel. Yeah, and so we jumped on the train, went up to Sleaford. Normally we weren't allowed, the Cranmel cadets weren't allowed into Sleaford because it was an area kept free for the non-commissioned people, so they weren't forever bumping into people from the college. You know, they had an area where they were free from all the military stuff to a certain extent. So, but we went to Sleaford, and then a coach met us, and met Sergeant Cliff Ross, who was bawling us out and marching us round. And the first thing he did, of course, was disappear into the hairdresser's and have a haircut. We went to our accommodation, which was called the South Brick Lines, which were, I think, probably about 1938 structures. And they were little brick huts. As you went through the front door, there was a bathroom with about four sinks on the left and about three toilets and a shower and a bath on the right. You went through that door into the bedroom, where there were about six bed spaces. And then at the back of that was a sitting room. The only form of heating was stoves, which you were issued with coal to get this, and you had to keep the stove going. We did have batmen, one batman for six people, but they weren't allowed to do much for us because at that stage we were being in the normal Air Force or service bull we were doing, so we had to clean the place ourselves.
What did they do for you?
Not a lot. I think they basically kept the place tidy. I think they did a certain amount of pressing for us. But no, I can't honestly remember too much what they did because, as I say, I can remember doing most of it. So that was the accommodation. There was a junior, what they called the junior mess, where we ante and there was an ante room and a relaxing area. There was, I think it was probably a billiard table, television room, and that sort of thing. But initially, it's a typical service thing. You were harried from pillar to post, bullying boots. Every morning you had to sort of do your bed space and have it square, just fold your blankets and have a box folding on the bed, all neat and tidy. Lots of inspections and polishing everything. I can remember we used to have a big inspection once a week, so we even used to polish the brass on where the bulb, you know, where you plug a bulb in. You know, even things like that, you used to polish that and all the normal bullshine.
Did you have any tricks? What did you learn?
Oh, well, no. Well, the first thing you learned was that anything that you were putting on display, you didn't use. So we were issued with shoe cleaning kits. We had our own razors and soap dishes and all this sort of thing. And we each had our own cabinet in the bathroom for this sort of thing. So the first thing you learned is anything you use, you didn't put there. So you'd hide that away in your locker in an area where, you know, you were allowed a certain amount of privacy. So everything was pristine and brand new. In fact, in the second term, I was a mentor. Yes, sorry, I hadn't put in that. One person in the room was from the senior, the next senior entry, just to help you show you the ropes. And that's the job I got in the next term for the next entry that came in. And I can remember, as a mentor, I was sitting in the sitting room once when these junior entry were being inspected. And Sergeant Cliff Ross, who we got to know later on, in fact, he got a commission later on. He was a lovely guy, but of course at that stage he was a demigod. And Sergeant Cliff Ross proceeded to tear into this guy, calling him all sorts of foul creature and dirty, filthy, ungodly sort of bad thing that you can think of. And this was a guy called Pat Swanton. And so after Cliff Ross had gone, I went out and I said to Pat, "Oh, yeah, he got into you a bit. What was your crime?" And what Pat had done, again, he had his razor, unused, straight from the shop. Never used it, but it was the one that was out for an inspection. And as a last thing, he'd polished it with a duster, you know, with the little red cotton round, tacking around the side. And a little bit of that red tacking got caught on the razor. So Cliff Ross had found this. So that was why he was a filthy, disgusting sort of person, you know, who was not fit to do anything. So that was a sort of regime. But as you got further into the college, you realised, of course, it was a game. It was just to knock everybody down, get you used to the service discipline. And
how did you feel about it initially, though?
In those days, I think the youth accepted what was done, and certainly in that context, you know, you sort of expected it. And this in a way, it was a game, and you could see it was a game. But of course, it could be a bit serious because, you know, if you've got restrictions or you wanted to get through Cranmel. You wanted to be a pilot in the Air Force, so it was just something you had to live through. But as you got more senior in the college, then you realise that it was part of the game. You could see why it was done, and it's still done today. If you watch the marine programme on television, you know, it's exactly the same sort of thing, is that you get everybody down to basics, because when you get them down to basics, you can see what sort of people they are. And we had quite a high attrition rate. In fact, we had one guy who lasted one night. Because again, having arrived there, as I explained, we next day we went and did all the filling in of forms and the oath attestation, this sort of thing. And one guy, in fact, he was an ex-apprentice, between leaving his apprentice training, Air Force apprentice training, and getting selected for Cranwell, he'd got married. And of course, that was taboo at Cranwell, you weren't allowed to be married. So he disappeared the next day, and presumably to go on, and he did his training, presumably, and through another system. So, yes, you've got people who quickly decided it wasn't for them, and they left, and others who, mainly on the flying side, I suppose, we lost people. The early days were, yes, quite sobering, but in a way, fun. In a way, fun.
How fun?
Well, because you made great friends. I mean, there's next month there's five of us meeting up in London to have lunch with our wives and just spend all the afternoon together and doing things. And there are five people know that we were at Cranwell together, and particularly you were in an entry. I was 81 entry, of which I think there's about 60 odd started and about 32 passed out, and then the entry was divided into four squadrons. So you had about eight or nine people who you were very, very close to, we still meet, we're still friends, you know, with a number of them, yeah. And the others, if I met the others, and we're still vaguely in contact, it would be just like the old time. There's no strangeness there, you know, because you spent 3 years under quite tough conditions, and you just got to know each other. I suppose we helped each other, relied on each other, and you really got to know people. There were no place to hide, because you were really stripped down and you had to do it. But that forges, you know, very strong friendships.
What was the relationship like between the junior entry and the senior entry?
They weren't too bad, really. There was a little bit of what they call crowing, but it was going out there. And this is, you know, when they come on, you have to do silly things like play pretend basketball and all sorts of things. But it was going out at that stage, because they'd been... At one stage, I mean, certainly I think probably between the wars at Cranwell, there were some quite, and even afterwards, there were some quite unfortunate things happened in this process. I mean, there was the famous instance of one guy who was running around. He had a flying helmet on back to front, so he couldn't see, but he was being forced to run around. He had his hands out in front of him, and he put both hands through a window, and it was quite badly hurt. So it was a feature, I think. I mean, you still hear of it in American establishments, but in Cranwell it's called crowing, and it was just this. Again, it's part of the process of a junior entry. As they were progressing through the college, they were beginning to feel their feet, and they'd been through it, so they took it out on the next junior entry. But it was dying out. I think it was not greatly approved of.
I've heard some people have said that it did have some kind of positive, in that they were teaching you things at the same time. Is that?
Yes, I think my experience was that those who were to the forefront in crowing and trying to push it on were not the most pleasant of people. I couldn't see a great, you know, removing people's self-respect. I mean, the system does it in a particular way, but it never humiliates people in that way, I don't think. There was not much of it. Yes.
And can you remember what were you taught, say, in the first month? What are the things you're learning?
I don't know if other people have said this, but if I had my time again, I wouldn't have gone to Cranwell. I would have gone to university, because I think the Air Force never really found out what they wanted to do with people for 3 years, apart from teaching them to fly. So we were in the process, as was Roger Annette. They were trying to sort out something. So the first term, I think we went to workshops, and we did things with metalwork, and we did things with woodwork. We had lectures and geography, history, this sort of thing, a bit schoolish, and obviously slanted towards the military, but they didn't really know what to do. And then so we became the first entry. They introduced really a three-way split. If you were on the art side, or people who with that bent, they did an external degree at London University. If you're on the science side, as I was, we did associate Fellowship of the Royal Aeronautical Society, which is basically aerodynamics, electronics, this sort of thing. We were working towards that qualification. And there was a bunch of guys who they reckon were probably not academically as gifted as we were, dare I put it that way, who just did general studies sort of thing. And they did went on doing the history, a bit of history, military studies, this sort of thing. And my feeling certainly is that I made a mistake by doing the science side, the FRAS, because at Cranwell we finished up trying to do three things. Get this quite a high academic qualification, sort of degree level academic qualification, learning to be an officer, and learning to fly. And of course, the three don't mix, particularly if you're not academic high flyers. Most of us weren't, because if we wouldn't have been there if we were. And particularly academics and learning to fly don't mix, because you've got to burn the midnight oil to keep up with it. And of course, if you burn the midnight oil, you want to go flying next morning, you're not in the right state. So I made a mistake, and it was quite interesting. The two guys who really did well in our entry and finished up as Air Chief Marshals didn't do the academic side. They concentrated on doing the general side. So from that point of view, Cranwell didn't know really what they wanted to do with people, and I don't think that was the answer.